This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? If you don't want to leave a review, that's fine, but I can't guarantee I'm not going to fill this little short intro with 5 to 10 minutes of plugs for Squarespace. Anyway, on with the show. We are living in a golden age of bullshit, particularly when it comes to the news media. We have never had so much choice when it comes to our news, but we've also never had so many people and institutions brazenly seeking to deceive us for their own political and financial benefit. We even have a term for it, fake news. So what is fake news? Are we just getting a peek behind the curtain of the way the media has always been? Or is this a new phenomenon in an age when anyone with a Twitter account can call themselves a journalist? And more importantly, how do we identify and stop fake news from spreading? On this episode, I'm joined by satirist and TV guy Toby Halligan as we offer a step-by-step solution to the problem of fake news. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I'm talking today to Toby Halligan, who is, you are a writer, you are a comedian, okay. You are a television man. What's your job title?
Sure, I like television man. Mm-hmm. Hello, I'm a television man. When you're passing through the airport and you got to write your occupation down, what do you do? I'm a television man.
I love the fact that you put on a radio voice to say television man.
I am a television man, you know, but I like, it's kind of more, I'm channeling the spirit of like, I'm an oil man.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm a television man, as if it somehow infuses my character or defines me.
Yeah.
You know, like, because I'm somehow kind of part of the Australian character by being a television man.
Yeah.
I'd say I'm a writer and a comedian.
A TV writer,
self-identified, yeah.
And you previously, The Project, and now The Weekly, with Charlie Pickering.
Yeah,
for our international listeners, I guess it's the, you know, it's the show.
It's like The Daily Show.
Yeah, The Daily Show.
Daily John Show Oliver. John Oliver. It's in that genre of kind of jokerism, if you like. You know,
jokerism.
Yeah.
Is that a phrase that is used to refer?
It's a phrase. What I'm doing is I'm giving away the secrets here. You know, the biz. You know, I'm really unleashing the big old secrets.
Yeah. So the hard hitting satire based news programs are referred to as jokerism.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like, where basically what you're doing is effectively unpacking an issue, and I mean, you are effectively engaging in journalism, but nonetheless, the medium you use to keep people's attention is comedy. You know, like, and through that you get a larger audience and you get an alternate perspective, I think, as well. I mean, we probably wouldn't go around saying, another day at the jokerism coalface, you know, like, it's not a universal term, but I think it captures quite neatly what that particular genre of comedy and of news programs does now.
So, because today we're going to talk fake news, and part of that is obviously the responsibilities that a journalist faced. What are the responsibilities of a jokerist?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, because the line between being like a comedian and a journalism, because like some of the stuff that I've written for the Project or The Weekly would almost more be within like the genre of journalism. It's journalism with jokes tacked on to the end. But I think jokerism, your obligation is to be both entertaining and accurate, and you aim to also kind of surprise and inform people about important things. Like, I think one of the things that I try to do as well is to actually unpack the underlying causes of different kinds of problems or of situations instead of just dealing with the superficial bullshit. So you can joke around about the superficial bullshit, but like I'm often kind of quite interested in trying to give people a little bit of insight into what causes different kinds of, you know, political, say, phenomena or behaviours or problems, instead of just joking about the lived reality of those problems. You know, so for example, with politicians' entitlements, like if I were going to write a piece about that, and this year on the basis of present form, I may well, it wouldn't just be joking about, you know, the avarice that a lot of the pollies seem to show, or their casual attitude to entitlements and taking the piss out of how ridiculous and self-entitled a lot of them are. It might also aim to unpack why they kind of, where that culture comes from perhaps, or whether there was a particular reform or cultural change that encouraged that, or has it always been like that, or is Australia an outlier, or is it, you know, consistent with the rest of the world. So I think in terms of my style as a writer, that, you know, means I kind of have always leaned towards the satirical bent, because I think when you're in satire, you're kind of into ideas as opposed to just, you know, telling topical jokes.
Yeah. There is, I guess, the... within satire, though, there always reaches a point at which you are lying to your audience, in that you are making a suggestion or something, making a suggestion or putting forward a concept or an idea, which is technically not true, but the audience knows that you're joking, and so they accept that, and by accepting that lie, they see a deeper truth. You know, they're like the clown, the classic clown gets to ridicule the king, and in doing so teaches the king a valuable lesson. But the problem, I guess, that we also have is that people often don't get the joke. There are people who watched Stephen Colbert's conservative pundit character and thought that the joke was at the expense of the left.
Liberals,
whereas there are also people who obviously watch it as he probably closer intended it, which is that it's a parody of the conservative pundit. So is there a responsibility to make sure people know when you're joking and when you're not? Because I know that Jon Stewart, when he was hosting The Daily Show, would, in interviews, would constantly bring up remind people, oh, I'm a comedian. I'm just a comedian. I don't have these responsibilities that you have as a journalist. He used that in his famous interview on Crossfire, that helped, which is super conservative news program. Sort of led partially to that show being cancelled, but also in, you know, people like O'Reilly and all of those kind of conservative figures in the States would sort of go, dismiss them, saying, I'm a comedian. But as a jokerist, which is, I'm glad we have that phrase today, because otherwise I'd be struggling. But as a satirist in a news type program, which is person behind a desk delivering news information directly to the camera, isn't there a problem that people can believe the bullshit and they can believe the lie, even though it's meant to be a joke and to reveal some underlying deeper truth, that people can be swept along and believe something that's not true? I mean, all of those people who read Onion stories, you know, everyone has a relative who you shared a satirical article from The Onion and they thought it was real and commented underneath and believed it. Is there a responsibility to make sure people know you're joking?
I don't think you have an obligation to write for the lowest common denominator, for the simple reason that there's this thing called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And the Dunning and Kruger were two academics in the United States, and what they discovered through testing was that the bottom 10 percentile of people who did tests were the most likely to overestimate where they fit into the rest of the cohort. So it was in the bottom 10% would be convinced they're in the top 10%. And people in the top 10% would be likely to underestimate how clever they are, because the people who were really clever presumed everyone was as clever as they were, and the people who were really dumb assumed that they were smarter than everyone else.
Yeah.
Because the same skills, right, that are required to do well on those tests were also required to know where people fit, right? So the challenge is when you've got like a very large audience, you know, that you're potentially playing to, I don't think you can necessarily write in accordance with people's ignorance, because it is actually very hard to know where that begins and ends.
Yeah.
But does that make sense? Like, it's actually challenging, you know, if you're someone of like a certain, you know, like say of average intelligence, to know what dumb people will do and what they'll pick up. Like, for example, from the Podesta emails. So this was a leak from John Podesta, who's a prominent member of Hillary Clinton's staff. And a conspiracy theory has grown up around those emails, because in those emails, there are references to pizza a lot. And there's a particular pizza establishment in Washington. And what the internet has done is read into some of these odd references to pizza in these emails. It seems like pizza is probably a code for some emails, right? Is that there is a pedophile ring that operates out of a pizza joint in Washington, D.C. that Hillary Clinton is indirectly involved with, right? How could anyone have predicted that somehow. And the reason those connections have been made is because people have looked at some of the advertising for this pizza joint, and like one of it, you know, looks kind of like apparently there's an international couple of symbols for pedophiles, like ones for, you know, like sleeping with boys or like sleeping with girls. And they think there's a vague resemblance in some of the advertising for this pizza joint. Who could have possibly predicted such an insane thing would evolve out of just random emails, right? So I guess when you're writing, if a large portion of your audience isn't sure whether you're joking, you've probably failed. You've probably written something and the joke has not landed. But I don't think you can necessarily ever write to accommodate like everyone's ignorance, mm-hmm. because the simple reality is we all have such weird internal bias and biases that we choose to shut out certain facts that make us feel uncomfortable. We prioritize news sources that kind of endorse our points of view. So that's why when you've got conservatives watching Colbert, of course they're going to frame Colbert in a way that makes conservatives look favorable. But the thing is, they'd probably do that with every news source anyway. But what you were saying before about Jon Stewart and how he positions himself and he says, I'm a comedian, I'm not a journalist, I think that's a little disingenuous. But I think what Stewart's actually doing there is positioning him with reference to the rest of the media. So as in, he's not actually saying we have no obligations of any kind, but more that we are here in this space offering commentary on you. We are not the people generating the news stories. We are not going out and doing research. We're engaging in commentary on the larger news media. We're like a remora on a shark, if you like. So he exists, and this is true of me and the kind of work that I do and the kind of shows that I work on as well. We're not out there, like, although sometimes we do like hard journalism and research stories and unpack them properly and break news. But Stewart's argument, I think, to say that he has no moral obligations is wrong, and I don't think he would see himself that way either when he breaks it down. But when he goes on Crossfire or when he's like arguing with Bill O'Reilly, relative to those organizations, because the core purpose of The Daily Show or of John Oliver is not just to inform but also to entertain, it's relevant to say that relative to these media entities and their purpose and how they operate, we are just comedians, you know, and our core focus is not just to be taken seriously.
Yeah. When you talk about Pizzagate, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago with Stephen Greenspan, who wrote a book called The Annals of Gullibility. Mm-hmm. He's a psychologist. And so we talked about the mental processes that you would go through to actually believe a story like that.
Yeah.
I guess the difference between with Pizzagate is that's not someone perhaps creating an idea from nothing, is that there is a sense that perhaps that is a conspiracy theory that has been specifically created and maliciously created in order to get people to believe it and to denigrate the parties involved.
The Clintons and the Democrats.
Yeah, basically to get people to not like Clinton, you know, to assume that the Clintons and the Democrats are involved in these kind of shady dealings.
Yeah.
And that is where we come to, I guess, the real topic for today, which is fake news, this idea of not people misunderstanding news or conflating things or getting the wrong end of the stick or the Dunning-Kruger effect or confirmation bias. This is people specifically creating news stories that they know to be false in an attempt to either control the national debate and the media landscape, or to just get clickbait, to get clicks on a website.
Well, I think there are three forms of fake news right now, and it's shifting and changing all the time. There's fake news that's created by content creators, sometimes based in the United States, sometimes based in Eastern Europe, that, as you say, is just designed to get clicks. So, for example, NPR did kind of a study about the Denver Guardian that is a fake news site, basically, and had a headline that one of the FBI agents who'd been involved in, you know, investigating Hillary Clinton had been found in a murder-suicide, and it was just completely made up. And the purpose of that story was to get clicks to sell advertising. And so those people are, you know, scammers in the vein of Nigerian scammers or, you know, anyone who posts any of those kinds of stories that are purely where their fundamental purpose is to get people to click on things to download Trojans or to get people to, you know, go and see gambling sites, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think there's people like Donald Trump and people who, you know, tried to create a conspiracy out of Pizzagate, some of whom just did it out of, you know, partisanship, some who do it with the specific intention, you know, like as in who naturally do it because they're suspicious of the Clintons and then they just see connections in the world that aren't there, and some who do it maliciously with the intention of actually attacking the Clintons. But Donald Trump's been the source of about 14 fake news stories, like 14 big fake news stories.
Now, when you say the source, do you mean he is responsible for spreading them, or do you say he is responsible for starting them?
In a couple of cases.
And tweeted,
Well, the stories? Birther conspiracy, for example, would be a
But he did not start the birth. He was not the first person to start. So he helped spread it and helped make it stronger, but he didn't. He
With
wasn't the source.
All of these, whether he's the absolute originator or not, or whether, say, Alternet, which is a far right kind of conspiracy site, or 4chan, which is like, you know, a den of trolls in the internet.
Pranksters, yeah.
Whether they originally kind of... Well, I think they're more than pranksters.
Yep.
No. A lot of them are pranksters.
Yeah, they are trolls and pranksters.
Yeah, for example, like 4chan has helped coordinate Russian airstrikes against ISIS through like identifying stuff in the background of videos. You know, like they're more substantial than pranksters. But so the story that Ted Cruz is... Trump provides a megaphone, if you like, to what would otherwise just be bullshit conspiracy theories. Like the idea that Ted Cruz's father was involved in a plot to kill President Kennedy, the Central Park Five being guilty and deserving the death penalty. This is when he's gone on. Thousands and thousands of Muslims were cheering 9/11. All of these stories, the kinds of things that people might tweet randomly or people might post on Facebook. But when Trump comes out and says them, then all of a sudden you're reaching a colossal audience and you're legitimizing them.
Yeah.
Because... Well, he's a legitimate celebrity, you know, like he has to a certain segment of the population as much credibility as Meryl Streep does to another section of the population. And so...
The difference there, though, is, and I think it's an important distinction to make, is that he could be doing this for purely malicious reasons. He could know that it's fake and be spreading it anyway, or he could be an idiot, delusional, you know... Yeah. Partisan, any of those sorts of things, and trying to, you know, spread it for that reason. And I think that's a clear distinction to make. You know,
there are
people who start pyramid schemes, and there are people who get sucked into pyramid schemes. And people who get sucked into pyramid schemes can end up making a lot of money and benefiting from them at the expense of other people, but they may not necessarily have started it themselves.
My inclination would be, I think it might be something more complicated with Trump. I think that he is very good at identifying things that are going to entertain people and stories and perspectives that are going to entertain people. And he is a bullshitter. And he spent a large portion of his life telling stories, some of which have a grain of truth to them, some of which are half true, some of which are not true at all. So in a lot of ways, he kind of anticipated. He was doing what we now know as fake news a long time ago. A lot of fake news is just rumor. Like it's been with us since there were more than two people in a group. Do you know what I mean? Like people, that's what fake news fundamentally is. It's just now the mechanisms for spreading it allow it to be spread so quickly, and because social media has cannibalized so much of the market for news media, and social media is almost perfectly positioned to spread fake news because it tends to create little isolated gardens, you know, bubbles, if you like. So Facebook, for example, I think bears a very substantial responsibility for the spread of fake news, because at the beginning of last year, a story emerged that Facebook's, there was a team of 23 staff at Facebook, I think it was 23, something like that, who were engaging in editorial oversight on the news that was, that popped up. You know, Facebook has like a trending column and stuff like that now. When that was introduced, and a news story broke that they were removing some links that were not authoritative, you know, and that was sites like Alternet and InfoWars, which is a conspiracy theory site run by Alex Jones in the United States. And Facebook fired all those people and replaced them with an algorithm. And then the next day, a story broke about Megyn Kelly being fired because of, like, it was a made-up story about Megyn Kelly, the Fox News anchor, who'd been in the headlines a lot because she had confronted Donald Trump at different points in interviews. And it was about her being fired because of having a secret bias to Hillary Clinton. And it was just made up. And that was spread through Facebook. And that was kind of the beginning of this recent wave of fake news. So I think social media, the British Parliament, I believe, is actually going to be holding commissions into fake news. And I think that's probably a good thing because Facebook has failed in a pretty fundamental way to actually... I think that social media agencies have presented themselves as having no moral or ethical obligations. We are just a business. If you choose to use this, then fine, but we don't have any obligations beyond that. I think that's bullshit.
Well, they've gone further than just we are just a business, because the newspaper is just a business mm-hmm. as well. But what they have said is we are just a place. You know, we are a method of communication, and that if someone, you know, if one person lies to another person yeah. on the telephone, yeah. we don't hold our telephone.
You don't
blame the phone carrier. But of course, that's not true because, you know, obviously that the Facebook, as opposed to, you know, any social media really, can decide what you see and what you don't see. Mm. And they can decide what is in your newsfeed and what isn't
in
your newsfeed.
They make choices all the yeah. time.
And even if those choices are made by an algorithm, or even if those choices are made by a system that is in place and not by a specific team of people, mm-hmm. the idea of we're going to leave it up to an algorithm yeah. is still a decision that they're going to make.
That is an ideological choice, mm-hmm. in effect, because you've got to, I think, judge as well the implications and the consequences. And in this particular, in the last election cycle in the United States, one of the consequences, and there were a lot of factors that went into Trump succeeding, was that a lot of people on both sides of politics believed a lot of made-up stories about the other side. Now, would plenty of those people have still believed those stories, like independently of Facebook? Then probably, yeah. Like mm-hmm. a lot of them would have sought those websites out in any case. But I think more studies have shown that something like a quarter of all Americans have shared a fake news story. And most Americans are actually not able to distinguish between fake news and real news. So that's a real problem, because it means that truth and accuracy all of a sudden lose their currency. Mm. I mean, in a lot of ways, like at different points and to differing degrees, in different mediums, truth and accuracy and honesty, and obviously establishing objective truth is a hard thing, yeah. But I think we can probably all agree that there is a difference between, say, the truth and the accuracy of, say, the way a right-wing shock jock reports a political issue and the way, say, the ABC attempts to report political issues. You might make an argument that the ABC has, you know, that their journalists have their own internalized biases and stuff like that, but they make a conscious effort generally to report both sides. And they usually, you know, are required by editorial policies to have sources of different kinds, et cetera, like that.
But there's a big difference between bias and reality. You know, like you can have a bias towards one politician or the other, and you can always report the negatives of one politician and the positives of another.
Yeah.
And that's not fake news. That's no. just editorializing.
Absolutely.
But when you start lying about the person who's there, that's clearly when it becomes fake.
But there's also something interesting in this as well. And like this story that broke in the last week about Trump enjoying golden showers. So the story, for those of you, like I presume most of your yeah. audience will have heard
no,
about this.
No, sorry, I haven't. Golden, what is...
Tell me more
about golden.
To what doth thou refer?
Yeah.
So Donald Trump was in Moscow and he was at a hotel and he specifically requested the bed the Obamas had been in. And then the claim of this source is, who I think has been identified as Christopher Steele, an MI6 agent who claims to have gotten it from sources in Russian intelligence. There's a video of Trump getting some Russian prostitutes to urinate on the bed, a golden shower.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the story is true is kind of irrelevant now, right? Because it so perfectly fits with our views and a lot of people's attitudes to Donald Trump. It is actually an unsurprising story.
Yeah.
It's one of those stories that makes you go, oh, of course he did. And it feels like we've been, I think, on this pathway for quite a long time because of increasing tribalism in the United States, but around the whole world, and increasing political polarization, where we kind of are in a post-truth world in the sense that if you really loathe the other side enough, you'll believe anything about them. And the truth of it doesn't matter, because the truth is you loathe them enough to believe these absurd, awful things, you know, about them. It's kind of like when the right in Australia, a lot of the right-wing media, ran that campaign against Julia Gillard, suggesting she was dodgy and that because her ex-boyfriend had been involved in some shady dealings when he worked in the unions. And like the connections they made to Gillard were so peripheral and had been kind of investigated and revealed to not be particularly substantial. But it fit with the worldview of those writers and their view of Gillard. And so in a way, these made-up stories or these false connections came to have more meaning to them than real actual scandals where, you know, like she actually, you know, made mistakes or had, you know, made poor decisions or had done things that reflected poorly on her. And it's kind of the same with Trump. Liberals now prefer, I think, because it fits with our worldview, to think of him as this kind of, you know, weird devil type figure. When, look, he's just, you know, a bully. And does he encourage racism? Yes. Is he misogynist? Yes. Is he a good, well-prepared to be president? Probably objectively not. But nonetheless, the prism through which I think a lot of the left sees him is crazy too. Like we misrepresent what he represents to a lot of his supporters, and by we I mean like the left and progressives, etc., because it fits with our worldview.
But in the case of Golden Showers, what struck me as really interesting was that not just that it fit with our worldview or that it was an attractive story that we wanted to believe was true, but that we enjoyed the idea of Donald Trump getting angry and annoyed, and the idea of him reading this story and getting all upset. And so Twitter then became for 48 hours just full of wee puns, just one after the other, and that were hilarious, absolutely hilarious. And so, and mostly perhaps from people who were pretty sure it wasn't true, but didn't care because they wanted to make the joke and they wanted to score the political point. And so it was a case of almost willful ignorance, that we were happy to live for a short time in a fantasy world where we, you know, it was role playing. Let's imagine a world where this is a true story and let's play with it for a little while. But the thing was, in that same leaked document was far more important information about the hacking of the Democrats. The election leaks. And the email leaks and all of that sort of fell by the wayside in an attempt to grab the headlines and talk about
It's because, like, even mainstream news sites that, you know, still claim to be a credible source of news are in a battle for clicks. And so they, you know, whether they like it or not, have to engage in, because, you know, getting advertising dollars in order to, you know, do that, they need to get people to read their sites. And people aren't interested in the serious, substantial analysis compared to the fluff. People click on fluff. What we're learning, social media, I think, is teaching us a lot about human nature, and it's that we're generally not as substantial as we claim to be. Like, you know, we click on the Kim Kardashian story. We click on the story about the dog, you know, playing with a hedgehog. No, people don't want to read about economic policy to relax. People don't want to necessarily have a deeper understanding of the world. They want to have their understanding of the world confirmed. And so I think what we're beginning to realize is that the media, that we're getting the journalism we deserve, and often it's insubstantial and sometimes it's completely made up.
You talk about the learning about more about human nature. What is interesting is we talk a lot on the podcast about how a con artist will get you to believe the story early. And then everything that happens after that becomes inconsequential because you have already decided that you believe the story. So if you get an email and you think that maybe you have won the Spanish lottery, it doesn't matter how much information you are presented after that, because you have already reached that belief. And in fact, often arguing with people only makes that belief stronger. And so in the case of fake news, what you have is a headline will pop up on your newsfeed that you will be drawn to. It's a clickbait headline, and it's drawn to you and your beliefs, and you instantly invest in that by clicking on the link. And so as soon as you click on the link, you are accepting that this headline is true. Mm-hmm. You're not clicking on it to investigate whether it's true or not.
Mm-hmm.
You're clicking on it because you find that enticing and want to see you and want it to be confirmed.
Yeah, want to believe it.
And want to believe it. And so by the time you've clicked on that link and started reading that article, you are already on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that happens after that, so the argument that you have in the comment section, the actual reading the article, the fact that you then share it, all that does is just make you believe it even more.
Mm.
And of course, it spreads to other people because you have shared it. So it is, we talk about an article going viral, but it is like a disease. It is, mm-hmm. it is something that we actually are seeking out on a neurological level.
But it's a disease that we willingly spread,
mm.
like amongst our friends. Like there aren't very many diseases that we kind of voluntarily, because I mean, it's a form of ignorance.
Yes, we do willingly do it. It's not, there's not a gun to our head. But I think that we give ourselves
too much credit.
We give our free will too much
lesson,
credit.
That's exactly it. Like the lesson in a lot of this stuff has been that actually, like, free will is much, we have less free will than we think we have.
Mm.
That actually, you know, and that's what a lot of behavioral psychology has delved into in the last kind of 30 years. Like it's been the classic kind of economic assumptions are that we're each rational individuals and that we allocate resources in a rational fashion and that we make decisions on the basis of evidence and we're making calculations about the world and how it operates. But the more we learn about human nature, the more it's revealed that even for particularly smart people, we're all wandering around with our heads stuck up our ass, believing our own bullshit most of the time. I've actually found in some studies that the people who are most likely that when it comes to ideological positions that are important to group identity, so for the right in the United States, a belief in, you know, gun rights and access to guns, for the left generally around the world, belief in climate change, when people are presented with information that challenges some of their assumptions about that, the smarter the person is, the partisan individual is, the more likely they are to dismiss evidence to the contrary. Like, so there is literally a correlation between being intelligent and dismissing, like, evidence that challenges some of your underlying assumptions, even when the evidence has solid foundations.
Mm.
So that kind of begs fundamental questions about how our brains work and how we interface with the world and reality. Like it begs fundamental questions about what truth actually is when seen through the prism of the human brain.
Because when we talk about these sorts of things, and we've probably been guilty of it a lot in this conversation, is that we are always talking about other people.
Mm.
You know, we're always talking about, you know that crazy aunt that shares all that weird yeah. Donald Trump stuff that she totally believes, but that I know is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that both you and I have shared...
You in particular.
Me in particular.
I think we're all guilty of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think knowing that you're guilty of it is an important step towards beginning to check some of those instincts.
Mm.
Because the only way you can, like, possibly even begin to recognize when you're being unreasonable or when you're being overtly partisan is, and this is one of the problems with people who decry increased tribalism and partisanship. There's not actually something inherently wrong with being strongly attached to your side and believing strongly in certain value systems. The problem is that we reject evidence that undermines those arguments, or that we are unwilling to make concessions to people,
mm-hmm.
even when they have a good idea or they've got a good policy or they're doing things on good faith or for good reasons because of their ideology.
And this is something you saw a lot during the US election, was that the arguments were not being made. The arguments were not being made that this article is false because it's false or this article is a lie because it's a lie. It was Donald Trump is an idiot because this article is a lie. And if you're a Trump supporter, the only possible way you can argue that is to then turn around and say, no, this article is true, and therefore Donald Trump is a great guy and we should all vote for him. So, okay, I think what we should, in the time we have left, we should nut out a 10 or however many step program to rid the world of fake news. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the first step is admitting that we have a problem.
Everyone, it's start of, yeah.
Listeners, either that let's clean our own houses first. Let's try mm-hmm. and find our own biases first. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you and I are friends on Facebook, and we have a lot of friends who share a lot of news articles and a lot. Mm-hmm. So we should be looking at the news articles that we are sharing first mm-hmm. and considering them. Now, obviously, we know arguing is not going to help. Like getting into a fight in the comment section about whether something is real or not is.
Why doesn't that help?
No,
I presume that was a way to heal the world.
No, I think posting a link to Snopes is always a bit of a that
nice
always
passive aggressive.
That's way. A nice passive aggressive way to just because for a lot of people, even if it's not the person who posted the article, for a lot of people they see the word Snopes, they don't even click on the link. You could post like a serious article that's completely false about Pizzagate, but then. Click, you know, just put a little Snopes link down the bottom mm-hmm. to some article about
a 50-year-old
urban legend. Doesn't even mm-hmm. matter if it's relevant. People go, oh, Snopes debunked it. I won't. It's dead as far as so. But you've got to get someone smarter in there. So Snopes link, but not argue. I think that Obama in his farewell address said, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking to them in real life.
Yeah.
So I think that is like don't argue.
Well, but that's true. I mean, like, especially online. I mean, it's true with everything, though. Like, they've done studies that have found, you know, the chances if you ask someone for something via email, you've got like a 5% chance of getting it. Whereas if you ask them face to face, you've got like a 90% chance of getting it.
Mm.
You know, those figures might be a little out, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
And it's the same with convincing people of their political points of view. Like, I've had reasonable conversations with people who I fundamentally disagreed with over, you know, in person or over a beer or, you know, over a coffee. And at the end of the conversation, like, I'm much more likely to have taken what they said seriously if I was talking to them like a human being than if they're just some rando on the internet. Like,
yeah.
I mean, one of the things I've been doing a little less is posting articles, like, unless I think they're kind of well-researched or bringing, like, an alternative perspective to mainstream stories. Even when I'll see these stories that confirm, you know, underlying political instincts that I have, and I'll still want to post them because it makes me feel good. Because it's like, oh, Trump and Tillerson, and look at how bad these people are. You know, old man yells at cloud kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to not to do that anymore. Because even though, like, I know from posting nerdier articles that are longer and that are more nuanced, people don't give a crap. People don't like them on Facebook. A lot of people probably don't read them. But, you know, and then you post the partisan stuff and everyone's like, yeah, let's jump on board. But it's just worthless.
Yeah.
Like, it's fundamentally worthless. It's a waste of everyone's time.
I just post funny New Yorker cartoons now when I get angry.
That's good, man. I mainly post pictures of dogs.
Yeah.
So, like, dogs that I like, dogs that I want, dogs that I've seen.
I've started posting like classical poetry just in case, just so that's people good. Think I'm smarter and more emotionally engaged than I am.
That's
that,
good.
That helps too.
I think that's what a lot of Facebook is, though.
Yeah.
A lot of Facebook is personal branding.
Yes, you're right. And if that personal brand can be, I am a Trump supporter, let's push it out there. So it sounds like if you are going to engage people, do it in real life and don't make it partisan. Don't make it about... Yeah. telling that person that their beliefs are wrong or their ideals are wrong, but we're trying to get to the fact.
They're probably not a bad person. I mean, some people are. Like, some people are bad people.
Yeah.
But they're probably not.
Yeah.
And if they are, why are you friends with them?
And again, maybe we are bad people.
Yeah.
I mean,
I know bad people who I politically disagree, who I politically agree with, you know, who are in my tribe, if you like, and they're bad. They're real bad.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a skeptic. I was at the Skeptics Convention a few weeks ago, and I had a couple of conversations with people there most 99% of the conversation I had were with lovely people who were very interested, but there was a few conversations I had that just made me sort of reel with, not necessarily whether they were right or wrong, but just how unpleasant they were in the expression of that opinion,
yeah,
and
how terrible they were,
and how not a great person they came across in conversation.
Mm.
And again, if you come across as patronizing or condescending or aggressive, you are not going to change anyone's point of view.
No, but also working on the presumption that, you know, people are that this, therefore this, that, oh, you say, for example, 49% of people in Australia ostensibly don't want more Muslims to immigrate here, including like one third of Greens and 40 something percent of Labor people. That's a lot of people here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been beginning to like members of my family and friends of mine have been, you know, voicing kind of discomfort, like when that group was arrested just before Christmas. And I don't agree with them. Like, I don't think Muslim immigration is the problem. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. There's other layers to it that are, you know, radicalization and different sects within Islam and the role of Saudi Arabia and spreading kind of Salafi Islam. Like, there's all these, it's complicated. It's really complicated. And, you know, I know a bunch of Muslims that I've been friends with for a long time who I know are great people. And you know, like all these things that we kind of are all true, right? But it's not useful if someone kind of begins expressing, like, you know, a concern about, say, increased Muslim immigration or Muslim refugees, to be like, oh, you just must be the worst, or you must be a racist. Because, like, there have been recent events in the world, and there are logical reasons why, for example, a gay person might have legitimate questions about, is increased Muslim immigration to Australia going to mean that gay marriage is less likely to get up? Is it going to leave me at risk because, you know, Islam treats or perceives homosexuality in a certain kind of way, right? And in order to unpack that, people need to be allowed to express the first thought without people presuming, oh, this, therefore you're a racist or you're a bigot, right? Because people can be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think one of the big problems we have right now, this has partly been, I think it's too easy to put it down to political correctness or identity politics. And, you know, making judgments about people you disagree with has been going on, again, for the whole of human history, yeah. But right now what will happen is someone will say, tweet a dumb thing, or they'll say a dumb thing, and then that thing will be reported on the internet. Then a huge number of people jump on board and shame them. And it kind of ignores the fact that the way people grow and learn is by saying dumb things and then talking to people who have alternate points of view, and those people being like, well, actually this and this.
Mm.
And then sometimes people correct their perspective or they nuance it. Sometimes they ignore it. And if someone, say, chooses to, you know, if someone begins with a position that when you unpack it is bigoted, they're presented with an alternative evidence and they remain bigoted, then it's probably fair to render judgment, yeah?
Yeah.
But what often happens now is that people will say a dumb thing, or they'll do something insensitive, or they'll offend another group, and everyone will say, oh, you've said this thing that I interpret, you know, to be, oh, you've culturally appropriated this, you must be a racist, or you've used this word, this must mean you're transphobic, you know, when most people are much more complicated than that. You know, most people are a little bit hesitant and unsure of groups they haven't had much contact with over the course of their lives.
All right. You know? So our next rule seems to, our next step in battling fake news seems to be that it's okay to be wrong.
Yeah.
It's okay to be wrong. It's okay to be scared.
Yeah.
And that you don't want to label people as being wrong.
I just don't think it's particularly useful. I mean, you can still label them. I'm not going to tell people what they should and shouldn't do. But
I am. That's what.
Yeah. Okay. Fair play, sir.
Yeah, you don't start a podcast if you don't want to tell people what they're going to do.
Absolutely. What's the point of having a podcast, right? That'd be an oddcast. I'm terribly sorry.
That's okay.
I'm very
tired. That's what the edit button is for.
Yeah, yeah. We'll remove that. You know, and so I've, like, been in positions recently where, like, I've been talking to people and I've been openly kind of unpacking some of those kinds of issues. And if during the course, let me give you an example. This happened a few years ago, actually. I was doing a stand-up gig, and during the course of that gig, I used the phrase fucktard, right? I was using it to describe a politician I don't like, and it got a good laugh. People liked it. Like, mm-hmm. I'd built up this notion that this particular individual was not a great person, and then I used a lazy line to get out of it, right? Not great joke writing, whatever. A good friend of mine at the time was a lady called Stella Young, who, you know, quite well known,
mm-hmm.
very unfortunately died a couple of years ago. Who's a disability advocate, and for those of you who don't know, was, you know, in a wheelchair and had you know, kind of a leadership role, not a formal one necessarily, but an informal one through editing Ramped Up, which was a big online site for, that talked about issues of disability. And she talked to me about the fact that the word tard's very offensive to a lot of people, that, you know, it's a pejorative term, and we kind of unpacked it. And over the course of that conversation, I didn't immediately agree with her. Like, I unpacked it and we talked about it for about 15, 20 minutes. And at the end of it, I concluded that she was right and that I would stop using it. And I did. If she'd simply said to me, you're being, you know, anti you know, you're being ableist or you're discriminating against people with mental disabilities and you should stop and not like actually talk to me through her perspective, then I probably like it probably wouldn't. Like at the end of this, because of the way Stella approached it, we became closer friends because of it.
Mm.
If she just labeled me and, you know, told me you're a bad person for doing this, it probably would have, you know, had a negative impact on our relationship. So I guess it's worth like trying to put yourself in other people's shoes, because everyone says things that are fucked up sometimes. And the way you learn that a thing is seen as fucked up by other people is because people tell you that they don't like what you're doing. And if you hear that and it's explained to you in a reasonable way and you choose to ignore it, maybe you're a bit of a douchebag. But if like your way of convincing someone that they should not engage in a certain form of behavior is to call them a C-bomb or what have you on Twitter, then like don't pretend that you're doing anything but masturbating into the wind. You know, you're not doing that to make the world a better place or to help that person or to correct behavior or even to really represent the particular group that you're ostensibly defending. What you're doing is effectively a form of kind of a virtue signaling. Yeah.
Here's my, because that's, I agree. There is, I was having a discussion with someone the other day about a particular writer who engages in a lot of aggressive interactions on social media. And just gets really angry with people and fights all the time. Gets, you know, and also is, because of that, is also attacked a lot as well. And I would sort of point out that I, similar to what you just said, that I felt like that was kind of pointless and not great for the cause and not a great way to engage with people. And their argument was that in some tribes, the you would have two chiefs, and you would have the peace chief, and then you would have the war chief. And the idea is, in times of peace, you, everything is fine and everyone is nice to each other, but when people are being, you know, aggressive, you need someone to step in and be aggressive. And it was the role of this particular person to be the war chief, in this case for feminism, to go out on behalf of feminists and point out terrible, you know, injustices, and when people are attacking women online, to step in and attack back and to be aggressive and to be mean and to be nasty. And they felt that was the place for it. And I thought it was an interesting idea, but I still feel like that has an audience and that just breeds more
distaste
and distrust.
I understand the idea. I don't really agree with it though, partly because what winds up happening is that the peace chiefs simply get no attention. That what gets all the attention is the drama. And so that what people focus on, what people think is the whole debate, is the arguments that the war chief, so to speak, is having with other trolls online.
See, where were you when I was having this discussion 3 weeks ago? Because that's what I should have said.
Yeah.
I just kind of, I was at a party and just kind of mumbled into my Diet Coke and went in the other room. But those.
I understand that perspective and where it comes from. Like, it comes from a strong desire to push back against deeply gendered assumptions about women, to engage with sections of the community who are misogynistic and who people feel need to be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some merit to that argument. But, I mean, who are you convincing, though? Like, what's the end goal? Are you trying to convince the people you're arguing with online? No, I don't think so. In fact, the very nature of that kind of discourse means that no one's going to be convinced in any way, shape, or form. Are you trying to convince observers? Because I don't think, from the conversations I've had with a range of people who've observed these kinds of flame wars, I don't think anyone gets convinced of anything. I think everyone gets convinced that the internet is bad or that this is a bitter, horrible, divisive issue. When the reality is, actually, when you unpack it most of the time, I think a pretty substantial portion of the population are actually on board with more ideas than we think. Or they could be brought to a place where they will be on board with those ideas. But what needs to happen is they need to be taken along and guided to that.
Is it just a three-year-old just wandered in?
Your daughter just popped her head in while we're having kind of a...
B? What you doing? What are you doing, honey?
It was a bit much. We just come
from
a little break.
Sure. Oh, a bit much, was it? Yeah. Okay, you go and have a little rest and come back after. Okay, B was at a pool party for listeners and she just came home because it was a little much and she needed a rest.
It was so adorable.
I think there's a lesson in that for us. Is that maybe when you're on Twitter, rather than just keeping going,
have a little
go
rest.
Home, have a little rest, come back later on.
Yeah.
Can we add that as a rule?
Yeah, well, that, it's a good rule. But, I mean, there's some ideas, yeah, that in order to get the mainstream attention, you do need to fight and you do need to push back and you do need to challenge people. But I also think that once you've tried doing that, you've got to step back and appraise how effective that's been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some cases, some people are effective at doing that because over the course of flaming people, they interweave logic that compels other observers or it leads to other people to get involved in the fight. And that perhaps that's a good thing, but do you really want more people engaged in the fight, so to speak? Is that if the end goal of the fight is to say, stop women from being sexually assaulted or to encourage people to support domestic violence leave or to encourage paid parental leave, then the way you actually bring people with you, I think, is typically having more nuanced arguments. Or what you're aiming to do is actually get leaders, like little tribe leaders, other little tribe leaders, to get on board with your ideas. And I don't think you necessarily do that by pointing out that someone's got a small dick on Twitter. Although,
or on a podcast.
Mm.
I just, you didn't just have to say that, but now everyone knows, so thanks. Thanks a lot.
Well, you are naked.
Fake news. Fake news. All right. I think that that should perhaps be the final stage is don't call it fake news, because I feel like shouting fake news, Donald Trump has very much ruined the phrase fake news.
He's already gotten on board as well.
Because you just say fake news, exclamation mark.
He's an early adopter, isn't he?
Yeah, but that does, that instantly brands it as... It basically throws the story into this massive pile that is, it suddenly makes the issue much more complex. If you say this is fake news or not fake news, it adds layers of conspiracy and intent and partisan that perhaps you don't need when you can sort of go, oh, I wonder how much of that is true.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the problem for Trump doing that is that it's actually easy to discredit his claim. So if he declares that something is fake news and then more evidence emerges, then, like, it's quite easy to discredit it. I mean, let's be honest, like, he's playing to his core tribe and they probably are going to, they're not going to be swayed in the meantime by you know, other sources of media.
Yeah.
Trump is going to need to start effing up in pretty substantial ways before the people who voted him in are going to be dissuaded. And a lot of people who voted for him voted for him to smash the other side, not for anything substantial.
No.
Like, it was a rage vote.
Yeah.
You know, they rage quit democracy, basically.
Yes. And as we've already established, rage does very little in these types of things.
It's a sterile emotion. I think even the ancient Greeks used to kind of form that view that it just is, it all it leads to, you know, is table pounding and chest thumping.
Do you know what else is sterile?
What?
Russian prostitute wee.
I did know that, actually.
I didn't know
through long and bitter experience.
Very bitter.
Absolutely.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming in. I'm going to write out our stages of dealing with fake news. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for coming on. We were talking, we're just briefly touching it. Can you come back and talk about the fake bomb disposal?
Absolutely.
Bomb detector units we were discussing. We were just talking about fake bomb detectors.
Yeah, I'd love
which
that.
Which is a massive subject and one worthy of another episode.
Sure.
If people want to, are you on, like, Twitter? Do you tweet? Can we start fights with you? How do we do that?
Yeah, you can go at Toby_Halligan. You know, if you want to send me a DM, I'll probably, you know, respond and engage with you. I haven't been tweeting as much recently.
So if we really, truly want to engage, we got to come around your house in the middle of the night.
Chat
as we said, in person, face-to-face, knock on the door.
Yeah.
Come out, Halligan.
So what you do is you break into the house, right? There's a balcony up top. So get a grappling hook and come in there because we generally don't lock that door, and walk in while I'm sleeping and then wake me up right when you're face-to-face with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to convince me.
Great. That's a good, yeah, because you, when you've just woken, that's when you're in the best mood.
I'm also real likely to listen to you. I'll be like, sure
go on.
Random person in the night.
Tell me. The other place to see you face-to-face is at Political Asylum most months.
First Sunday of the month.
At the Brunswick Green. It's fantastic. It's 5:30. I've performed a few nights
there.
It's a lot of fun. Basically, political satire of all shapes and sizes. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure.
This has been Scammapalooza, For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.